Today on The Grave Talks, decoding messages from the grave. A haunted mine where the spirits of more than 100 who died in it come back to give messages to the living. A young woman is stabbed to death in 1969, and in 2016 her identity is finally revealed after an investigation brought on by visions delivered to a man who could possibly be considered a suspect. These are just some of the true ghost stories we discuss today with Tony Filosi and Darla Jackson on The Grave Talks.
Well, in the early 1970s, there was an outbreak of UFO sightings, especially down south. I lived down south at the time, and I found myself very, very interested in anything UFO or ghost related. I also was really interested in mythology, history. One of the first books I got as a child was Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods. And that kind of got me on the path. And then later on in life, I had some experiences I couldn't explain. So that really piqued my interest, and I've kind of been hooked ever since.
What were some of those initial experiences for you, Tony? I want to hear that, and then I'm going to ask the same question to Darla.
Well, the first experience that I had was there was this sword that some folks had found in Ohio, and it was allegedly had some sort of activity attached to it. And being I was probably 19, 20, and they were good friends of ours. And I said, hey, can I check the sword out? And it was allegedly an old Roman sword, but they could have got it at the bazaar. I don't know, but the story was cool. Mm-hmm. But I brought it home, and I had it in my room. And maybe a week or so later, I woke up with a white mist over top of me. And, you know, I woke up out of a dead sleep, and I was frozen just for a second, you know, trying to figure out what this was. Yeah. So it startled me, you know, scared me. And I kicked up, and whenever I kicked through the mist, it was cold, very cold. And then just as quickly as it had came, it dissipated. So that was the first thing that I physically had seen that was unexplainable. And that, you know, that got me digging even deeper into the paranormal.
What is going through your mind as you're seeing this mist and maybe trying to connect some dots? Obviously, you're startled. You know, you feel the chills of the air. But mm-hmm. What is right there in your mind? How are you processing this? What's going through your mind at that moment?
What is this?
Yeah.
What is this? Why is it here?
And what are you connecting to when you're saying, what is this? What's the answer that your mind is giving you at that moment?
At that point, it was just unexplainable. The house had allegedly had some activity. And I did hear some activity, you know, like footsteps and things like that. And I was living with my father at the time. And the house... I don't think they're, you know, they didn't relate any deaths or anything in the homes that could have been attached to the land, but we would leave and the drawers in the kitchen would all be pulled out when you would come back. So I thought, you know, and as I'm laying there looking at this mist, I'm going, you know, I don't know what it is. You know, your mind's going 1,000 miles a minute. You're trying to make sense out of this. Your logical mind is saying this can't be happening. Mm-hmm. And then, but you're seeing this thing, you know, this entity or this shape, and it's there.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to make of it.
very interesting kind of origin story, and I'm sure we can kind of jump into this a little bit more. But Darla, I want to go over to you and hear your story. Where did it begin for you? What's your earliest memory of finding interest or rediscovering a passion in the world of paranormal, supernatural, ghosts, and such?
Well, I was partially raised by grandparents who were what I consider older grandparents. They were from a different era, a different time. And I can remember just absolutely loving hearing their stories, and they had just the best stories. So I think I got interested in the stories at maybe 5 years old. But all I wanted to listen to was the scary ones. If my grandfather started telling me a funny one, I'd say, no. I want a scary one. I love to be scared. But I really had never had any experiences. I always thought that ghost stories happened to other people. Then at about age 13, I was with my grandparents. I stayed with them by choice almost all the time, especially in the summer. And I had an experience where basically in the middle of the night, the silence of rural Appalachia, where I'm from, just exploded with the sound of chanting and drums. Literally scared me to death, scared my grandmother to death. My grandfather ran outside with a pistol. He was a pretty rough fella. He was tough. He was in World War II and had been, just into all that kind of stuff. And so he ran out with a pistol.
Sure.
And we listened to this for, I guess, 5 minutes. And we never figured out where it was from or anything about it. I called neighbors the next day. They never heard anything. So, and I asked my grandmother the next morning, I called her Susie. I said, Susie, what was that? What do you think that was? And she says, well, I just think it was people having church. I'm like, okay. All righty then. And that was, I guess, the first introduction to the fact that the paranormal might not be something that happens to other people. It might happen to me too.
Sure.
So I guess that was the big defining moment where I at least entertained the fact that paranormal stuff does happen, and it happens to maybe everyone.
Sure. Can you tell us, when you look back on those experiences, and even before you had the experience at 13 with all of the drums and the noise and the music outside, what was one of the scary stories, briefly that your grandfather told you that really kind of piqued your interest? When you look back on those moments and you remember hearing him tell the stories to you, what's the one that really stands out that was like, that was spooky? That really kind of, that drove me down that road even further too, beyond just having the experience of your own.
Well, actually, the story that really, I guess, started it all was my grandmother's story. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was an amazing storyteller. He was larger than life and was just incredible. My grandmother was very soft-spoken. She spoke rarely, but when she spoke, everything she spoke was the truth. And she never told ghost stories or anything, but she had a story that actually occurred in the same location where my first experience happened. But she and my grandfather I'm thinking it was probably the 30s, late 30s, early 40s. They had basically a shack near the same place where their house that I knew was built. And they had dirt floors, and they had blankets for doors and windows during the summer. Mm-hmm. And this is very rural Appalachia.
Sure.
And they didn't have running water. And my grandfather ran a log yard. And so my grandmother would cook for all of my grandfather's workers. And then she would have to take the dishes to the creek and wash dishes. She would get a wash tub and wash dishes outside. And she said that most every night she could hear a group of people coming from afar. They would pass right by her. She could hear what they were talking about. She could hear different voices, male, female, children. And she said they would walk right by her, and then they would go out of sight, and she never saw anyone. She said, and I asked her again, I said, "Susie, who do you think it was?" And she said, I just think it was people coming back and forth from church." Like, okay, invisible people. It was always church.
Everybody's doing church.
That was always her excuse. Everybody's doing church. And so, but one night, a ball of fire popped up out of the ground, ran all over the yard, back and forth, made patterns, swirled, ran everywhere, came right up to her, to her feet, and went right back down in the ground again. And just knowing that my grandmother always told the truth, wasn't a good storyteller, didn't want to tell stories. I had to, you know, pull them out of her. But just knowing that those things happened to her, I think that really started, that's kind of what sparked the interest and made me absolutely love being afraid, love hearing ghost stories, and couldn't get enough of them.
Do you think your grandmother was more sensitive to the paranormal than the average or empathic with abilities?
I think so. There is a long line of that in her family. I don't think she would ever admit to it, mm-hmm. but she definitely had it. She was very mixed racially. She was Melungeon, which means it's a tri-racial mixture of Native American, black, and white, mm-hmm. and a little bit of Portuguese, a little bit of Middle Eastern. And she came from a tradition of healers and people who seemed to be intuitive. She was a little afraid of it, but despite that, I think she had it.
Yeah. When you look back on those stories and you look back to your experience on that same plot of land, all these years later, do you have any idea to the history of the land or anything of that nature? Because I mean, it all sounds very much like it has something to do with the geographic area in which these things happened, whether it be something residual or something conscious still kind of going over the land. Retrospectively, what's your opinion on what you think may have been going on in that area?
Well, my grandparents and my aunts and everyone in my family planted a garden. And in the spring, when it got burned off and plowed, and then in the fall when it got harvested, my activity, my favorite activity as a child, was to go through there and pick up arrowheads, Indian artifacts, relics. I still have them to this day. I would just pluck all of these things out of the ground. I know for a fact that there was a Native American village where that was, because I found too many artifacts. Mm-hmm. It had to have been. I think it might have something to do with that. It was also in an area called Straight Creek. And actually, my grandmother washed dishes from the water of Straight Creek. It was right there by the water. It would have been the perfect place for villages, probably for hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years. And just recently, a neighbor of mine from long, long ago, right there, right behind us, but on the other side of Straight Creek, she had no idea. I'd heard these experiences or had them myself or anything. And she said that my great-great aunt, Aunt Cynthia Cooper, used to talk about the invisible children that used to go down to the creek and play, and that she'd hear those children playing all the time. So other people actually heard that too.
So this is an area that obviously was very active for those who frequented it. Tony, tell me the story of how you and Darla connected here in this world of paranormal investigation and research.
Well, I've known Darla for years and years. She was a student of ours in a martial arts class we taught back in the 80s. So that kind of, you know, and then we didn't have very much contact through the years, and she would be at events, I would be at different events, and we would speak. And I had a book project, the Manzo Shepherd story, and I had hit a wall. And Darla is a very talented and accomplished author, and I reached out to Darla, and Darla said, "Sure, I'll help you with the book." And did a wonderful job. The Manzo Shepherd story is actually doing pretty well right now. That's how we connected back. And then after we collaborated on the book, we started doing investigations. And we have a lot of very similar thoughts on the paranormal. What was the first one we did? Was it the mines, Darla? Or was it the graveyard?
It was Portal 31.
We did an investigation at a place called Portal 31. It's an old coal mine that's been turned into a tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of activity in that mines. And we had actually done a short film on it. A fellow named Thomas Markham and myself shot an episode called just Portal 31. So if anybody's interested in that, they can check it out on Amazon. But when Darla and I investigated, there had been much, much more activity since we had went in. One of the mine operator is a friend of ours. His name is Nick Sturgill. And Nick kept telling me about all these crazy things going on, rocks being thrown, them seeing lights, miners' lights, hearing voices, hearing equipment run, people talking. So we got together and we did an investigation. And during the investigation, what we would do. I know you've heard of the Estes method and this, you know, other types of things that you do with a spirit box. What we would do is we let Darla put the headphones on Darla, plugged her into the spirit box. She couldn't hear a thing, and we would ask questions. And Darla would start giving answers, intelligent answers to those questions that we were asking. Mm-hmm. And the we got a ton of activity that night in the mines. The mines also, I was doing an investigation before, maybe a month before that, month and a half, and in the very back of the mines, we were running an EVP session, and I had everybody turn their lights out and act like that, the batteries were dead. We couldn't find our way out. Could you please help us? Trying to elicit some sort of response from them. And we didn't get any EVP. So we started back out of the mines, and maybe a couple hundred feet from the outside, you can go to another section of the mines, which is to the right. Well, that's what we started doing. But on the left-hand side, there's some lights which were off. One of the lights came on very dimly and then got very, very bright and then dimmed back out. And we fully believe that the miners were trying to show us the way out of the mines. So, and then Darla can tell you, Darla, what was some of the experiences that you had while that we were doing the EVP experiments?
Well, now, as far as the EVP, the ghost box and all that, as far as my experience with those things, what I was noticing is that in that mine, it seemed to be more I don't want to say intelligent, but it seemed to me more accurately responsive. It wasn't random things. You could literally ask a question and it would give a coherent answer, whether it be yes, no, dead. Sometimes it was short. Sometimes it was short sentences.
And I want to hear about what some of the responses were. But before we go into that area, and I'll let either of you answer, whoever wants to. When it comes to the history of this mind, what was its life like as a functioning mind? When did it get shut down? Why did it get shut down? Is there any interesting history of its active life prior to it being closed down and then later turned into a tourist attraction?
Lots and lots of death.
Yeah.
Well, it was started in 1917. The U.S. Steel started the mines. They built the town of Lynch around it. It was one of the most modern mining towns in the United States at the time. It had one of the first power plants. The power plant was built in 1917. And the town grew so large so quickly, they had to start importing even more electricity. The power plant couldn't keep up with the demand. But you had a lot of immigrants working in the mines. Mostly they were immigrants. Do you recall how many nationalities, Darla? 30-something, 40-something?
I'm thinking at least 30-something, close to 40.
Of different nationalities worked in this mines. And so there were deaths, not necessarily from day one, but there was a lot of death in that mines in the initial period. I think there was 160 something people killed in that mines from, we'll say 1917 to when they shut it down, I think in 1962 or so.
Wow.
And they kept a portion of it open because they were mining above it, and they would drop the coal. They'd put a borehole in and they would drop the coal down and they would belt the coal out of that mines to be loaded. But there's one particular story that sticks with me. There was a gentleman that worked 25 or 30 years in the mines. His name was Favaro. His last name was Favaro. And on his last day of work, he was coming out of the mines. He was about 100 feet from the outside of the mines. Last day, you know, worked 30 years. Sure. And on a set of tracks, there was a shovel over, I would imagine, to his left. He walks over to pick up that shovel, you know, last good deed before he retires. And there had been some coal cars that had broken loose from the locomotive. And he didn't see them. So he walks over to pick up that shovel. When he bends down to pick up the shovel, the coal cars pin him against the wall and kill him on the last day. So that's some of the things that's happened in that mines that we believe that contribute to the activity.
So when I want to get to the questions that you asked, but I want to just kind of move through the history of it a little bit more. When, as far as you guys are aware, when were the first stories that came out of this mine? Obviously, there's stories of death, and that's just, you know, it's factual. It's someone who perished on this site. But where were the original stories, or how far back do the original stories go, of unexplained activity occurring in the mine? Is it while it's still active into the 60s, or do those stories come about after the fact, after this mine becomes is shut down?
After the mine shut down, I became aware of them about 5 years ago.
Sure.
Whenever that the county started operating the mine, and my day job, I worked for Harlan County, and I would go up, and one of my duties are to inspect county properties. So I would go up, and these guys would start telling me these tales, you know, which I was in the paranormal. You know, I've been doing it about 15 years, you know, seriously, as far as investigations. And they would tell me, say, "Hey, man, we can't explain this. We can't explain it. Can you come up?" So after two or three times, I went up and we experienced some of those some of those things ourselves. But about five, to answer your question, about 5 years ago is when we became aware of them, as far as the paranormal side of it. Mm-hmm.
So between it shutting down as an active mine and then opening as a tourist attraction, mm-hmm. were there many years there where it just kind of sat abandoned and was almost one of those places where you'd have, you know, the teenagers, let's go to the mine, and everybody's saying, don't go in the mine, yes. That's dangerous.
Right, okay. Right. And from 1982, the last train load of coal was loaded out from that area in 1982.
Okay.
So from 1982 to the mid to late 90s, it lay dormant until they turned it into an attraction.
So when you were there and you were doing research and you're asking questions, what sort of questions are you trying to get answers to from the spirits that are active within this mine?
We try to get, where do you live? Which obviously the it's Lynch, Kentucky is where this location is at. And it's open to the public. If anybody wants to go and book a tour, shameless, I'm giving a Portal 31 a shameless plug there.
Sure.
But from, we would ask them, you know, obviously what's your name? And, you know, and if you get we'll try to compare names, a name that we get to what we have available that we know of the folks that work there. Mm-hmm. Or we will ask, how did you die? Yeah. Or did you die here? Do you want us to try to contact your family? Do you know, just the nuts and bolts to try to elicit an intelligent answer? What we don't do is we try not to do random, even though you will find things by accident, you know, but we try to frame our questions. We do a lot of research on the history, and we try to frame our questions to where that we get an intelligent answer that we can document, that we say, okay, this relates to this period in the mines or this event in the mines. Mm-hmm.
Darla, what was your reaction when you started getting answers and you're starting to dig into this story, and the questions are coming back very, you know, they're making sense. It's not just random words, and you're not just, you know, feeling uneasy, but you're getting intelligent responses back.
The first reaction was shock, because I see a lot of this going on TV, on YouTube and stuff. And sometimes I think people want a response so badly that in their mind they're getting correct responses. So I immediately start trying to debunk everything.
Sure.
And when I started being unable to debunk and it seemed like really accurate responses were being given, I was amazed. It made me want to do it more. At first, I didn't realize I had on my headset and I couldn't hear questions. I could not hear what was being asked. I was just repeating what I was hearing. And then later, I was amazed at how I would ask, how a question would be asked, and I would respond at the correct time and a coherent answer.
And let me interject that we did not front load Darla. That was her first investigation in that mines. We did not front load her with any historical facts, deaths, nothing. Mm-hmm. We just took her in blind.
Yeah.
And it was my first time ever in Portal 31. I'm not from the Cumberland area. And I probably know least about that area of the county. And I don't know a whole lot about the mining industry at all. Mm-hmm. I do not come from a family of coal miners at all.
Sure.
So this was, I was completely just raw.
Yeah.
As far as no stories, no nothing.
Excuse me, the music, Darla. Didn't you hear some music? And I'll build on that.
I heard what I thought was whistling. I thought I heard music, what I would consider would be on one of those big, huge radios back in the maybe the 30s, like big band kind of music at one point. I thought I heard a whistle, a flutey-like musical instrument at one point as well.
And that can be, that was the mind, to the tour guide, I don't want to call it, he's actually the director, Nick, he's had those very same experiences with the same type of music. He explained it very similar from that era, and he and Darla had not talked about anything like that. So that validated Nick's experience.
Sure. So I'm trying to understand just how this process is working. You're asking questions. Is that correct, Tony? Mm-hmm. And then is Darla listening to the spirit box, or is Darla simply replying?
Yes.
Okay. So it's what Darla is picking up through the spirit box. She's relaying out loud. You're not actively listening to the spirit box yourself. She's just relaying the words that are coming out that are standing out.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, Darla, when you're listening and you're hearing the music, you're hearing responses, is it intertwined with other words and other sounds? What is the purpose of having Darla have the headphones on and then respond verbally to you versus everybody listening to the spirit box out loud?
We do that too. We do an open one where everybody hears all responses. I think personally, it's just simply because when you have the headset wrapped really tight on your ears, you can just hear better.
Okay.
In my opinion. And also it's kind of an unprompted type thing as well. Just to see the validity of it.
Yeah.
My eyes are also closed too, so I can't watch lips. I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know what's going on around me. All I can do is listen to this white noise and an occasional sound of somebody saying a word or music or whatever.
Here's an interesting thought, and I'm curious to get your opinion and reaction to it. Do you think that a spirit box, just like a FM transistor radio or AM transistor radio, sometimes when you put your hand on the antenna, things come in better because you become part of the antenna. Do you guys think that by having someone literally physically connected to the device using headphones, you're part of the circuit now of this device. Do you think that you get better results going through that method versus it just sitting there off in the corner and everybody's hearing the audio and everybody's interpreting what they think they're hearing versus what you guys did with having the one person sit there, listen, almost are you, Darla, or whoever would be in that role acting as an antenna for picking up the signals in a stronger fashion than otherwise would be coming through?
I'm going to say yes. Just scientifically, humans are mostly water.
Yeah.
That's definitely a great conductor. Also, humans are basically just energy.
Yeah.
I think that definitely would create a transmission if someone is physically connected to the voice box. Also, you mentioned an FM radio. The one thing that I found the most credible about this is we were so far back in that mind, there is no way you could pick up any radio station whatsoever. And in Harlan County, radio stations are hard to come by, even in a car trying to pick up something. Back in a mine, it would be impossible.
Sure.
I think to pick up anything like that. So yeah.
That's very interesting because I think the assumption quite often when someone's using that is that And sometimes it is, you know, literally picking up pieces of broadcasts. You know, you'll get little things here and there that you could attribute to, oh, that's part of, you know, that song. That's part of, you know, some yes. station identification. You know, almost like the there was a song years ago, Fastball, called The Way, and the beginning sounds like somebody's tuning a radio. And that's what I, you know, like, oh, that's a Jewel song there, and that's this or that. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, almost a Spirit Box. But at the same point, if there's no signal to be picked up, where are those voices coming from other than someone using the energy and using that frequency to try and come through on it?
Right. And we think that, and that's one of the reasons we frame our questions, you know, so we'll have when we get a response, it's going to relate to a event that happened versus like what you're saying. And we've seen this before, unfortunately, people will get a snippet of a broadcast, and they'll try to lead the question, you know, it's and they do, and that's what we call doing random, you know, and they'll be in there and they'll go, is there anybody here with us? And there'll be a snippet of the song, and they'll go, it's Grandmother Jones. We knew you were here, Grandmother. You followed us from wherever. And then they go into their, you know, trying. They want so bad to hear a response. They start leading, you know, and I know you know what leading or begging the question mm-hmm. is, you know, and I think that unfortunately is what happens a whole lot with some of the Spirit Box sessions.
That makes sense. When you walked away from that investigation and you were getting intelligent responses, just opinion wise, where do you or what do you think the spirits of that mine are trying to communicate? Are they just there? Are they just kind of going about doing their job? Or is there some sort of message? I know that sometimes a very humanistic way of looking at it of they must have something they want to communicate. Sometimes they don't. But in your opinion, do you think there's something that's trying to be communicated to the living from the dead at that mine?
I think they just want to tell their story. And I think that after years and years and years of them wandering around and being able to see you and nobody knows they're there, some of them want to communicate. And like you said, there's some that do not want anything to do with you at all. But I think that the biggest thing is they want to tell their story or have some sort of interaction with you.
Very interesting. Let's move on to another location, another topic. And I always find this interesting when these two worlds intersect, the world of crime and the world of the paranormal. Tell me, and I'll let you guys choose who wants to answer this. How have you guys used your paranormal investigation skills to help in the cold case, an investigation of an unidentified murder victim?
That would be Darla. She did an excellent job helping identify a murder victim from Harlan County in 1969. I'll let Darla tell that story, of course.
In 1969, the body of a young girl was found on Pine Mountain in Harlan County. And I lived very near the foot of Pine Mountain as a child. I was born in 1969. So obviously I don't remember it, but I can, you know, my grandparents were storytellers and they loved to talk about this. That was such a profound event in my community because nothing like that had ever happened. And we really didn't think anything like that could happen. So I grew up hearing about the body of this young girl being found very near where I grew up. Life happened. And honestly, during my late teens and 20s, I was not interested basically in anything but being a mother and raising a family.
Sure.
So I wasn't interested in crime, the paranormal, or anything. And then in the year 2000, I was 31 years old. My uncle moved to by the cemetery where this Jane Doe was buried unidentified. And he started having psychic experiences, paranormal experiences. And it kind of brought it all back for me and my family. And he attributed all of this to this young girl, to this Jane Doe, who was found murdered, stabbed in Harlan County in 69. And she was definitely buried there. Through that, through his experiences, my aunt and I started trying to solve this, her identity, she is.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Tony Filosi and Darla Jackson. In part two, why does Darla think the spirit of the Jane Doe murder victim chose her uncle to tell her story through after her death? How did the police respond when Darla reached out to them with possible information on a 1969 cold case file? And is the spirit of the deceased woman at peace now, knowing that we know her identity? Or is the spirit still in search of her killer? Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.